directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
The old team. Sorry, Daniel. The old team back together. First time since we were together for that very relaxed evening in the London Velodrome for Bradley Wiggins, our record. Have we all recovered from that?
Yeah, certainly. It was a very long hour, wasn't it? Recording, broadcasting live from the centre of the Velodrome. Incredibly noisy. I woke up the following morning with my ears still ringing.
Indeed, I think we all did. And we needed a bit of a breather after that. We did produce a lot of podcasts that week, so we took a little bit of a breather last week and got to sort of recharge our batteries for the Tour de France. And a very hectic schedule coming out there, planning two episodes a day at the Tour de France. So look out for details of that. We've also got a couple of special episodes coming up. More details on the first of those later on in this week's podcast, but that follows a very top secret covert trip to Italy by Daniel Freeb, and he'll tell us a little bit about that in a few moments. In the first part, we'll talk about the Critérium du Dauphiné. We will also be looking ahead to the women's tour, but first of all, Lionel, I think you've got the weekly roundup. Over to you.
A very quick news roundup this week, but it was a very topsy-turvy week in the French Alps. Chris Froome prevailed, of course, winning back-to-back mountain stages at the end of the week. But there were also a couple of stage wins for Nasser Bouhanni of the Cofidis team, who finally got their sprinter into position to win some big races just ahead of the Tour. Romain Bardet descended like a demon on the Col d'Alos to win the stage to Pralou. And Peter Kenyuk, of course, won the opening stage and took the yellow jersey for a couple of days at the start of the race. I asked a couple of weeks ago if anyone had seen Marcel Kittel to drop us a line on a postcard. Well, we haven't received any postcards here at the Cycling Podcast Towers, but we have seen Marcel Kittel. He was sixth, winning the bunch sprint in the Rund um Köln in Cologne. The race was won by Tom Boonen. Marcel Kittel won the bunch sprint, finishing a minute or so just behind the leading riders. So perhaps his chances of riding the Tour de France have moved in a positive direction. That's pretty much it from the news roundup this week. Back to the show.
Thank you for that roundup, Lionel. And we should say before we get on with talking about the Critérium du Dauphiné, thank you very much everybody who listened to our first sort of proper live podcast from the Velodrome. Figures for that who listened on the night were very encouraging, and subsequently a lot of people caught up with it. We'll get better at that, I think, and the technology will hopefully allow us to produce a better quality recording, but very encouraging listener numbers, so thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I think the Tour de France is the ideal place to experiment a bit more with that, maybe do some live question and answer podcasts after the daily stages of the Tour de France, so maybe we'll plan to do that during the Tour.
Maybe we will plan to do that. So the Critérium du Dauphiné has been taking up most of our attention this last week. I was supposed to go out there and do a special day in the team car with Orica Greenedge on Friday's stage, which was proved to be an absolute thriller. Sadly, for boring reasons, I couldn't go, so missed out. But we are planning a day with Orica Greenedge for a special podcast for Friends of the Podcast coming up soon. But the Dauphiné, Chris Froome ended up the winner. A real battling performance from him. Nicholas Roach has written one of his regular diaries in the Irish Independent today, where he talks about how Froome never gave up, and at least if he was going to go down, he wanted to go down fighting. You know, he wanted to show character. I think after the stage in the rain, when Vincenzo Nibali escaped early on, and really having sat up the previous day, took the race by the scruff of the neck, thought then that Nibali would probably defend the jersey and win the race, but that proved not to be. What can you tell us, Daniel, about the way that Nibali rode? Because it seemed almost as if he was riding, if it was a training exercise for him.
I think conflicting statements from, or conflicting sort of impression that we got from Nibali last week. There was the stage of Pralou where he was dropped on the final climb to Pralou. He sat up, didn't really race the last 2 or 3 kilometres. I thought looked very unflappable, as he always does in that situation. It was obvious, or it seemed fairly obvious to me, that he wasn't too worried. The next day, however, in the rain, as you said, he really went for it right from the from the word go. He clearly wanted to race that day, clearly wanted to prove something to himself and to other people that he was on course in terms of his Tour de France build-up. He was extremely strong that day. I mean, the break, all five riders who formed that break, so it was Tony Martin, Tony Gallopin, Valverde, so six riders, and Rui Costa and Nibali were very, very strong. Nibali was the strongest of all, I think, although he probably went a little bit too hard when he attacked in the finale and got caught by Rui Costa and passed for the victory. However, then, over the weekend, again, more conflicting signals from Nibali, who I think his greatest weapon is this ability to just stay cool and not expend any energy on, you know, worrying about his form, worrying about the stages to come, particularly in the Grand Tour. And he has these great reserves of mental and sort of nervous energy. However, I'm led to believe that he's slightly worried or edgy just about the fact that Quintana, Contador and Froome have all had big victories so far this year. And Nibali has said that there hasn't been a single day this year when he's felt absolutely at his best, including the day when he almost won at the Dauphiné. So there's work to do, but he was in the same position last year. He rode a pretty off-colour Dauphiné last year. He went up to altitude on the Pass of San Pellegrino in the Dolomites, got ready and came back with sort of firing on all cylinders for the Italian Championship and the Tour de France. So if he does that again, I don't think he's got too much to worry about.
Nairo Quintana has been absent from racing really since the end of April. He's racing soon in the Route du Sud. He's been training in his native Colombia. Froome has been at Tenerife training hard. And, you know, Team Sky were strong, but they weren't all uniformly strong. I think there are slight concerns maybe with Nicholas Roach, perhaps not giving the backup that he would be expected to give. Wout Poels, however, has recovered from a nasty crash in the Ardennes Classics and looks very strong indeed.
How do you guys see it shaking out with Sky in terms of their team selection? What are the names that we can expect to see in that final nine?
Well, I know a couple of weeks ago, or a few weeks ago, Wout Poels was almost being ruled out, but he's come very, very good. I mean, Luke Rowe fell ill at the Dauphiné, but he was one of the first names on the provisional team sheet. Geraint Thomas, who's riding Tour de Suisse, is obviously nailed on for the Tour, provided nothing happens there. And I think, you know, Richie Port is an obvious one to come into the Tour team now, having pulled out the Giro. I did a feature on this for Cycle Sport magazine and have rank them A, B and C. I'll dig that out in a moment, but what are your thoughts, Lionel? Well, first of all, before we go on to that, perhaps on the race itself, I mean, what did you make of the Dauphiné?
Well, I think the thing about the Dauphiné is it was an extremely entertaining race because it was so unpredictable. And the reason it was unpredictable was because not everybody is necessarily at their absolute best. Everyone is choosing to prepare for the Tour de France in the way that they see fit. Chris Froome, the way he sees fit is to race very hard and race all out for the victory. The way Vincenzo Nibali saw fit to race the Dauphiné was to pick and choose his moments. You know, he swung out of the line twice on the final climb, so over Friday and Sunday. And the day that he actually, you know, tested himself to the full, he looked incredibly impressive, but he looked like he was picking and choosing his moments to make his maximum efforts, which is obviously not how he will race the Tour de France, because the Tour de France is not somewhere where you have that luxury. So it's quite interesting, really, the way the Dauphiné is being used this year and last year as a place to actually race and test rather than kind of defend and conserve, which is really what the Grand Tours are more about.
We have seen, some terrific racing recently. The Giro offered up a lot of exciting racing. And the Dauphiné this year and last year, the race has been turned on its head. And a lot of people make, you know, jump to conclusions on that. You know, we're seeing riders collapse with tiredness. We're seeing riders not be able to be consistent day after day after day. We saw all the riders who were in that escape with Nibali pay for it. You know, they all paid for it. Valverde certainly paid for it the next day. We're seeing more human performances. You're reluctant to draw too much in terms of hard facts from that, but the racing does look more human and is incredibly exciting, I think, at the moment. And the Dauphiné was perhaps the best example of that.
I'm not sure, Rich, about it looking more human. There've been a lot of complaints. There's a bit of a sort of background noise building about how difficult the racing has been recently in the World Tour races. People talking about the hardest stage they've ever ridden. a guy like Dan Martin made those kind of noises after the stage that Rui Costa won at the Dauphiné, the Giro d'Italia. People complained about how hard that was, all sorts of rumour and innuendo, which we've sort of frowned upon in the past. But certainly, I wouldn't say that there were too many reassuring signs in terms of the pace and intensity of racing, if we are talking about doping in particular. But, you know, as we've said before, speculation on these matters really leads us nowhere.
Somebody has to win.
Somebody does have to win, and I think the danger with the trend is that every style of racing can be used to fit a certain point of view. If the racing is very, very fast and very consistent, you know, I've said, made this point several times recently, just looking at the racing doesn't really tell us an awful lot about the cleanliness of the peloton. But what you can deduce from the Dauphiné is that it's a preparation race. It's not necessarily a goal of itself. You know, perhaps for TJ Van Garderen, who was very close to the overall win, it would have been a real feather in his cap, particularly after the difficult year he had last year. If he'd won that race, you know, a real morale boost going into the Tour de France. But was that particularly unexpected that Chris Froome would overturn that deficit, particularly with the time bonus that was available on the final day? I don't think it necessarily was, and I don't really think that you can really guess how good Nibali was in comparison to Chris Froome. You can look at them on each individual day and you can come up with one picture, but over the course of the week, I wouldn't necessarily say Nibali is far off where he wants to be.
I think if we talk about preparation for the Tour, one interesting aspect of both the racing at the Giro and the Dauphiné, which we'll maybe be able to analyse with greater clarity during the Tour de France, is how the difficulty of these races has affected what people thought was going to be their preparation at the start of the year, because no one can really budget for how difficult particular races or particular stages are going to be. And if you are dragged into or get yourself dragged into a battle for a leader's jersey or to win the race overall, as Chris Froome was quite happy to engage with at the Dauphiné, presumably that makes some difference to what is then your training schedule afterwards. Nibali looked to me like someone who, and this is uncharacteristic for Nibali, because Nibali is someone who throughout his career has raced, but he does look increasingly as though he's sticking to what he thinks is a schedule, and or certainly paying very close attention to the feedback he's getting from his body and not wanting to go too far into the red.
It's like in the old days when riders used to look at their heart rate monitors and sit up if they went into the red. But, you know, that point you make is very, very good, Daniel. It reminds me of the story of the 2003 Dauphiné and Lance Armstrong, the controversial Lance Armstrong, who was up against the completely uncontroversial Iban Mayo and got dragged into a fight with Mayo because he wasn't going to let that little punk win. And he'd fallen off. He was sort of battling injuries from that. But he got dragged into a fight that his coaches, Ferrari, Brunel, all the rest of them told him he shouldn't engage in, and he reckons it cost him at the Tour and meant that he started the Tour below par.
And these effects, whatever the effects physiologically of a battle like that, these have to be corrected in the period between, you know, for instance, the Dauphiné and the Tour de France. But that also goes for training, if mistakes have been made earlier in the year in training. And this is one thing that I'll be very interested to see and observe with regard to Tinkoff Saxo. We've spoken various times on the podcast this year about the things that they've experimented with in training, new coaches, new training methods, it not having necessarily worked for all of their riders. Ivan Basso, after the Giro d'Italia, felt that he'd spent far too much time at altitude earlier in the year. He'd spent 45 days at altitude before the end of the year. And that team was in a position, I think, with a number of their riders where they had to correct certain things that had gone wrong in their conditioning. And it'll be interesting to see how well they've done that.
And likewise, I think at Team Sky, perhaps, Nicholas Roach has been adjusting to a different training load. And it's perhaps not working as well for him as it is for some others. What's happened to Rafał Majka, the revelation of last year? Do you know what's happened to him? He doesn't seem to have done much this year.
Well, he's been making fairly optimistic noises about the Tour of Switzerland this week, and he concedes that he hasn't had the best start to the season. He's had a fairly quiet start to the season, but it was always going to be as such. And he's also looking ahead to the Vuelta a España, both the Tour de France and the Vuelta a España. He thinks he'll probably get opportunities, although he has to support Contador to win stages or to have at least have a go at a couple of stages at the Tour. And like I say, do very well at the Vuelta.
I think on the point about how hard the racing has been. One thing we do know about the Tour de France is that the first 9 days are going to be very intense. A lot of racing efforts will have to be made. There's obviously the opening time trial. There's the potential for crosswinds, which will make for hard finales to stages. There's the Mer de Huy, the Mer de Bretagne, your team time trial before you even get to the first rest day. So there isn't going to be, as we've seen in some tours, this thing where the GC contenders are almost detraining in the opening 5-7 days of the race because they're just sitting in the bunch following the wheels, not making those high end efforts. So, you know, having a hard Dauphiné may well play into the hands of Chris Froome and Vincenzo Nibali when they come to the Tour.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
We're still talking about the Critérium du Dauphiné, which just finished. But a reminder that we have our Friends of the Podcast program initiative, whatever we want to call it. Become a friend of the podcast for £5 for the year. You will get 11 special podcasts. We've only done 3 so far. The reason for the sort of slight hiatus is that we've been building a paywall, or having a paywall built, because none of us are actually competent enough to do that. That should be going active, if that's the correct term, very soon. All friends of the podcast will then receive a unique password and they can access the Friends of the Podcast specials. So more details on that at thecyclingpodcast.com. There's a page there which will explain all about the friend scheme and how to become a friend. Daniel, we've got one coming up very soon. It should go live in the next week or so, we hope. And it's a special, Mark Cavendish at home. And you went to see him recently at his Tuscan villa. How was that?
It was good. It was great. I don't know if you've ever seen MTV Cribs. He'll hate me for saying this, but it was very reminiscent of that. Great, a classic MTV show from the 90s, along with MTV Grind, of course, all our listeners will remember, The Grind.
Sure. It's a very interesting listen. I mean, Lionel and I have both listened to it. It's about 45 minutes long. Just you chewing the fat with Mark Cavendish. You obviously know each other very well. And there's some absolute pearlers in there. Let's go back to the Dauphiné in the meantime. Simon Yates, one of the, I don't know if we can call him a revelation, but second year pro, 22 years old, finished fourth overall. The stage to Praloop, where Nibali really ripped the race apart. Yates took off on his own from the chasing group behind. It looked an ill-advised move because it certainly didn't look like he was going to catch them, but he covered that last bit of the course, the climb, faster than anybody else. It was a very impressive performance. He ended up in the white jersey ahead of Romain Bardet, who's a rider who, you know, is a top 5 finisher at the Tour de France. Really outstanding, perhaps not a surprise, but confirmation that he is as talented as we think he might be, the Orica Green Edge rider.
Yeah, I think we'll see Simon Yates make an even bigger impression on the Tour than he did last year, and he made a big impression then, getting in breakaways and cutting the shape of a man who was disappointed, really, to have to go home and not actually make it all the way, probably perhaps saved from himself a little bit there, not exposed to too much of the rigours of the Tour first time out. But this year, it will be really interesting to see whether he can mount a challenge for the white jersey and see how well he gets through those first 9 days, because if he loses time in those first 9 days, then he's really going to have complete freedom when we reach the Pyrenees and the Alps, and he could well be the man we're all talking about in the final week.
I think that's the thing. The ability is clear and obvious, but it's the attitude that he and his brother Adam Yates seem to have, where they're not remotely daunted to be in that sort of company. I mean, to be in, you know, alongside Chris Froome and Nibali and Valverde, and to attack them and to feel that you belong in that company at age 22 is quite extraordinary. And he clearly isn't somebody to get carried away either. You know, his interviews are, he's always very sort of down to earth, stroke doer, even. Daniel?
I think they're in the perfect environment. I think it was an absolute masterstroke turning pro with Orica Green Edge on several levels. I mean, we've spoken before about the self-acknowledged difficulty that Sky have in developing young riders. They've been fairly self-critical recently about that, rightly so, because they haven't developed young riders particularly quickly or particularly well in certain instances. At Orica Green Edge, they've been able to fly under the radar, not too much pressure on them, not too much media scrutiny. And there is a sort of power vacuum there as far as Grand Tour riders are concerned. So they've got an awful lot of freedom. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the position that Warren Barguil's in at Giant Alpecin. It's a team that is ostensibly set up for a different type of rider, but it means that there is a spot there for someone or a couple of guys like the Yates twins to really just have a lot of ride with a lot of freedom, and that's what they're doing. And they're very excited at Orica Green Edge about both riders' potential. Yates has been spoken up as a future tour winner. I would be loath to stick that label on him or any other rider, because we've done that many times before with many different riders. However, everything is going swimmingly for them at the moment.
And Adam Yates was 20th at the Dauphiné. You know, he might not have been too aware of him. That is also a very promising performance. He's been coming back from injury, hasn't raced that much this year, and may just be coming to the boil for the tour. I gather both of them are going to be selected for the tour, so we should see them riding together there.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is that your podcast doping motorbike turning up there with some scoops on it?
They'd have an ice box.
Yeah. I think you look at Simon Yates and Pete Kenyuk riding for Team Sky in the Dauphiné. Simon Yates with Orica Green Edge. Pete Kenyuk had a good Dauphiné, won the opening stage with a real sort of cold-blooded finish on the opening day, took the yellow jersey, held it until the team time trial, which was an uncharacteristically poor ride by Sky in that, which may cause some concerns, although I think the Tour team will be significantly different from the Dauphiné team to correct that. But then Kenyuk was really on sort of mountain domestique duties, which Simon Yates didn't have to worry himself about. He was riding at a young age as a GC contender in the Dauphiné, whereas Pete Kenyuk's development on that front has been sort of stunted by team orders, really.
And we've spoken about this theme of opportunity many times before. I've mentioned it in relation to the French riders, how few big stars there were in France for so many years, and that created a situation where these guys were thrust into races like the Tour de France. And we saw Thibaut Pinot in 2012 at the Tour de France, and Simon Yates last year really thrown into the Tour de France at the last minute, and that was midway through his Neopro year. Pete Kenyuk, it was 2013 before he rode his first Tour de France. It was his fourth year at Team Sky. However, we've spoken about Pete Kenyuk on numerous occasions in the past few weeks, and we talked about how slow his development has been at Sky. We thought this might be a good reason for him to perhaps leave Sky, because he himself perhaps felt that his development had been too slow. Latest news on that is that he's very likely to stay at Sky now. We talked about him negotiating or having...
Very like my Geraint Thomas scoop last year.
Having had conversations with BMC, our latest understanding is that he will probably stay at Team Sky next year and renew his contract.
Well, here's my A, B and C for the Tour de France, Team Sky. In my A band, Chris Froome, Nicholas Roach, Geraint Thomas, Luke Rowe. I think Wout Poels as well now will have ridden himself into the A band. Band B, Richie Porte, Mikel Nieve, Bernard Eisel, Peter Kenyuk, Sergio Henao. And in C, Ian Stannard, Leopold Koenig, Vasyl Kirienka, Christian Knees. Stannard had a very good Dauphiné and may have moved up a band, I suspect. I think he was, a few weeks ago, he was a serious doubt for the tour, but I think he'll be right back in contention.
And Kirienka very low down there, Rich, in the pecking order. Why is that?
I don't know, it's just where I figured he's ridden the Giro. He may move up a band, Daniel. Anything's possible.
And Paul only in band B?
Well, I think they had to see how he came out of the Giro and recovered from that. You know, he did ride 2 weeks of the Giro. He was injured at the end. He would have had a little break, see how he is. Any news on Richie Porte?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Richard, because it's another topic we've covered over recent weeks in the podcast. Richie Porte, is he going to stay at Team Sky? Dave Brailsford, the team principal of Team Sky, told us on the eve of the Giro d'Italia that it was a matter of when, not if, Richie Porte was going to renew. I understand that after Porte's fairly, let's say, unsuccessful in Giro d'Italia, he pulled out at the end of the second week. The negotiations have hit a little bit of a snag, and Porte's manager has been speaking to other teams. Sky have made him an offer, perhaps not quite as much as he wanted. So his future is very much up in the air, and I think BMC certainly is one team that's very interested in Richie Porte. This situation, as a lot of these cases are at the moment, is constantly evolving. You imagine that BMC might have been on the lookout for a GC leader or another GC leader to go along with TJ Van Garderen, and made someone like Richie Porte an offer perhaps the last week, and Van Garderen's ride at the Giro, the Dauphiné, has made them revise that. But certainly you know, Port will go into the Tour de France, I would imagine, not knowing for sure where he's going to ride next year.
I mean, he's bound to have offers, isn't he? It's not going to be a case of any port in a storm.
No, it's not. Before we wrap up on the Dauphiné, though, we've got to mention Romain Bardet, surely. One of the outstanding rides of the week, and particularly taking advantage of a descent which will feature in the Tour, I think, Nicole Dalos. And a lot was spoken about what a tricky descent it is.
Mainly by me. It was like a one-man campaign on Twitter.
It's a long while since. I think it's 2000 was the last time they went over the Col Dalos in the Tour de France. But it was relatively well used in the 80s. I remember it from those years. But it really is. It's narrow. The corners are tight. There's a lot of those kind of off-camber corners where, you know, if you're going round a left-hander, the road drops away, and very daunting sort of drops off the edge of the road, and the road surface as well, just watching on the TV, looked bad, lots of patching up. But Bardet's descending was absolutely excellent that day. And the other interesting thing looking ahead at the Tour was one of the most televisually exciting looking climbs, certainly from a distance, the shoelaces, Daniel, the Lacet de Montvernier, which looked incredibly spectacular. Fortunately, the UK TV coverage just about caught the main group going over the top or reaching the top of that climb, and that really whet the appetite for the alpine stages of the Tour. It's not just the usual kind of, you know, the big menu of Galibier, Izoard. You know, there's going to be some really interesting stages in the Alps, I think.
Now, you mentioned Dave Brailsford earlier on. I think you fellas had a word with him after the Wiggins Hour record in the Velodrome. We'd like to introduce your little chat with Dave Brailsford.
We didn't mention transfers, though, when we spoke to Dave Brailsford, for the record.
Now, what did you talk about?
We spoke about Wiggins' successful hour record. It just broken the world cycling record.
World indoor cycling record. Okay, let's hear now from Dave Brailsford.
Okay, Dave, one of your phrases is controlling the controllables and all of that. How would you sum up Bradley Wiggins' hour record attempt?
I'd say that was a fabulous performance. It was gritty, it was hard for him. It wasn't an easy, flowy, smooth kind of ride. You know, he really had to grind that out. He had to dig very, very deep. It was heavy, you know, but he paced it well. And, you know, it's the fastest we've ever seen ridden in an hour. So it's terrific, isn't it? You know, it's exciting.
You've worked with Chris Boardman a lot, so you must know what goes into putting an attempt like this together. It must appeal to the way you kind of like to prepare for events.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was great to be back in a track, to be honest. You know, it brought a lot of memories flooding back, listening to, the roof coming off this place. And I think, you know, I stood in a corner so I could see Heinko's board. So every lap I could see what the splits were, which was fascinating. So I knew exactly what was going on. And things like the choice of gear, I thought it was interesting. You know, he went down a gear.
So what was he on?
I think it was on 111. I double-checked that. But he definitely went down a gear from what he was planning to ride in, which was absolutely the right choice. You know, so Bradley's a peddler. He's a peddler. And if he went on a big gear, you want to push it, he'd have got ground down here today, got bogged down on it, and that would have been difficult. So it's just those little decisions. And, you know, they're big calls, they're big decisions, and they're done by guys who really understand performance. So credit to Bradley, credit to Heiko, credit to Shane Sutton, who made that decision. That's for me, that's what gets me excited, and they did a fabulous job making those types of decisions.
Where does it stand in terms of the Tour de France win and the Olympic time trial win and the World Championship time trial last year?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to try and rank order them, you know. I think when as soon as you try and compare and contrast different events at different times, I think it's it kind of, everyone's special in their own right. I mean, the Tour obviously was something that had never been achieved. It was a big goal. We'd all worked towards it for a long time. And it was a bit more like a test match. It dawned on everybody slowly but surely. A bit like, you know, he was obviously going to break the record. After a certain point, you think, right, he's not going to lose it. He's not going to not do it. But the question is how far. And I think that was the Tour. It kind of built into a, yes, it's going to happen. So at the moment when it actually happens, it's maybe less of a jumping up and down and going crazy than Chris Hoy winning the Keirin, you know. So I think they're all different in their own right. They all represent different things. But he's an amazing character, Bradley, and I think he's you can see from the way that the crowd connects with him here. You know, he's a man of the people, isn't he? And people absolutely love him. And I think as a nation, we need to be very, very happy that we've had him as one of our great sort of sporting legends now and ambassadors. And he just represents the country so well.
Just one thing, Dave, you know Brad better than anyone. He's been adamant this is once and once only. the conditions probably weren't ideal today. Is there any chance that he'll come back for a second bite of the cherry, do you think?
Well, only Bradley can answer that, really. I think when you build an event around it and there's nobody else involved but you, yourself riding around for an hour, I think that adds a huge amount of pressure to the whole situation. And I think if he was to, you know, jump on a plane, get in a really, really good shape, go to altitude and you know, ride at altitude, that would be interesting for sure. And who knows, he may do that. But I don't think he maybe do it to the same level of, you know, with the same sort of fanfare around it and all the rest of it. But, you know, he can set his mind now. He can set his mind on the towards the end of this season and now getting ready for the Olympics.
In terms of British cycling and how far it's kind of come to have a sold-out velodrome to watch one man ride round in circles for an hour, it's quite an esoteric event to get your head around, really. Very simple, of course, but not necessarily sort of a box office kind of event to watch. But
it's got some kind of attraction, hasn't it? Because I remember going, when I was a lot younger, I went to watch Boardman, you know, break the hour record in Manchester when it was the only velodrome in the country. And I remember watching that and thinking, wow, this is unbelievable. And the place was packed and it was same, you know, he was screaming and shouting and he did a great ride. And so I don't know what it is about the hour, and I guess obviously the velodrome is a stadium as such where you can sit and you can watch the whole event without, you know, it's the closest we've got, isn't it, to a, you know, a football stadium or some of the big sport athletic stadium. Whereas road cycling and mountain biking and, you know, BMXing even, you know, you're more outside, doesn't have the same environment. So there's something special about events in a velodrome, and even if it's one guy going around for an hour on his own.
Lastly then, Chris Boardman's ultimate hour record, 56.375. Judging against what you've seen Bradley do today and taking into account the air pressure and all of those other factors, do you think Boardman's ultimate record will eventually tumble? And if so, how soon do you think?
Well, at some point in time in the future it will. You know, if we just think that everybody, you know, the human body keeps increasing in terms of its performance, we get to understand more about aerodynamics. Of course, he had a big aerodynamic advantage. So I think, yeah, at some point you've got to believe that that'll be broken, but it could be a long way off. But there again, you know, with different air pressure, different conditions, and, you know, maybe Bradley have gone close today. I think the interesting thing will, and the guys will do the analysis, they'll look at the power he produced over the hour, and then you can do all the calculations into different sort of pressures and say, well, with that exact ride would have propelled him X amount further in different conditions. And then you can start to get a real feel about whether he'd have got close to Boardman's record, whether, you know. So I think there'll be a lot of analysis that'll give some real insight into that.
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Coming up on British Eurosport, Tour de Suisse, every stage live on Eurosport Player, highlights on British Eurosport. So that's what's going on this week. The other big sort of Tour de France warm-up stage race. Daniel, you were going to come in there.
Do you know what we were going to talk about and we haven't spoken about, in spite of the motorcycles drawing up behind us? We were going to talk about motorised doping, weren't we?
Go on then.
Well, motorised doping, I predict this being quite a big issue at the Tour de France. There's bound to be a day when this controversy sort of boils over again, or people start speculating. Probably a quiet news day, the cycling equivalent of silly season, the Tour de France, isn't it? Anyway, there was a lot spoken about Contador's bike changes at the Giro d'Italia. L'Equipe even went so far as alleging that he was using a motor in his bike, and on the stage over the Mortirolo, Ivan Basso had given Contador a wheel when Contador had supposedly punctured, and then Basso put the punctured wheel back in his bike and carried on riding. And been doing a bit of research about this, or making a few calls over the last couple of weeks, Rich, and I have a theory about Contador and his wheels. I've been speaking to various people who have worked with Contador over the past few years at Saxo Bank, Tinkoff Saxo, and what they say is the public don't realise, and probably other people in cycling don't realise, how fastidious Contador is about his equipment. More fastidious than probably anyone that certainly people who've worked with him have ever encountered. And
Nicholas Roach talked about this in January at the Team Sky Camp, saying he was obsessed by air pressure and tyres and things like that.
Yeah, particularly wheels and particularly tyres. Something that I heard last week was that since about 2012 or 13, Contador has been using an exceptionally thin tyre for the final climbs of mountaintop finishes, and he actually has been changing wheels and replacing his wheel replacing his tyres with an incredibly thin tyre, which probably only lasts, it's a bit like the running shoes you can now buy, which are only good for 100 kilometres or even less, 50 kilometres. And Contador's tyres supposedly are so thin that they might only last 15 kilometres. But this is obviously a secret he doesn't want to give away. He could probably defuse these rumours about motorised doping quite easily by explaining this. However, he's not doing that because...
You're giving it away instead.
He really feels that this is giving him a major advantage. That is certainly one theory. I wouldn't say that is a confirmed explanation for all of these bike changes, but it's certainly, in my opinion, a reasonable explanation.
Interesting.
What do you make of that?
I think that's fascinating, and it does confirm what, as I said, what I was told by Nicholas Roach, that it wasn't something I really appreciated about Contador, that he had never met somebody who was so into his equipment and so such a perfectionist and very interested in tyre pressures and things like that. And again, that tyre pressure is something that obviously can change in the course of a stage as well.
And in Contador's case, it's very much a team between him and his personal mechanic, Fausto Munoz, who he's been with since, I think, his Neopro's days at Once. And Fausto Munoz is someone who looks for very innovative solutions to technical questions. You hear stories about him. He's one of these guys who'll hang tyres up for a long time in his garage, or he'll turn up to races with a particular kind of cork brake pad, or not necessarily sort of cutting edge, latest off the production line technology from major manufacturers, but things that he's worked on himself. And with bearings in wheels, apparently he's very, very fastidious. There have been big debates, I understand, with equipment suppliers to Contador's team about the safety of some of the solutions that he's wanted to adopt in races. But Contador is so obsessed with weight or efficiency of what he's using that often he and his mechanic have held sway in those discussions.
There's no question that equipment and gains in equipment is a big topic. It caused a minor controversy after the Wiggins Hour record when Alex Dowsett's helper, not his coach as he was described by some people, not his coach but somebody who was certainly helping him on the night of his Hour record, with time checks and so on, claimed that Wiggins had used a bike that shouldn't have been approved by the UCI because it's not for sale in the marketplace. Now there is a question of how do you decide what commercially available is a very woolly, vague term, isn't it? Anything can presumably be commercially available, and so what does commercially available actually mean?
Indeed, and I think one of the things about the big brouhaha that blew up about Wiggins' Hour Record bike in particular was that we heard from Ernie Feargreave, the mechanic who was looking after Wiggins' bikes in the run-up to the Hour Record, and he said how they had been checked and would be double-checked and checked again by the UCI officials. And really, once the UCI have given the green light for the bike, that's end of story, really. But it certainly does. The Tour, I would imagine, is going to have these two twin strands of technology doping, for want of a better word, and actual doping. And motors and blood manipulation will be on the agenda, no doubt, during the Tour.
Well, look out as well for our other forthcoming special, the Perk, the long-awaited Perk, that will be available either just before the Tour or just as the Tour gets underway, we think, again, for friends of the podcast. On the Wiggins Dowsett brouhaha, I understand Movistar were very embarrassed by that little scandal and were in direct contact with British Cycling to apologise for it and to express their gratitude for the help that they had got for Dowsett's record attempt in the Manchester Velodrome. That was one of the other complaints that he'd had, that Wiggins had too much help from British Cycling. And it did occur to me, Tim Kerrison who works for Team Sky, and there were quite a lot of Team Sky people involved directly or indirectly in Wiggins' Hour Record. Now that's now a rival team, isn't it? So Simon Clark Richie Port was penalised for taking a wheel from a rider on another team, but teams, and it's happened in the past. Well, Rod Ellingworth coached Mark Cavendish when he still kind of coached him when he was at Team Sky, wasn't he, initially? So Rod was at Team Sky and Cavendish was at HCC High Road and he was coaching him. So there are these, it's curious that you can be allowed to be coached by somebody on a rival team but not allowed to take a wheel from a rider on a different team. Anyway, just a thought passed through my mind. We should look ahead to the Women's Tour, which is coming up. Second edition of the Women's Tour starts in Suffolk and finishes, I believe, in your neck of the woods, Lionel.
Not far from me, Hemel Hempstead, yeah. That finishes on Sunday, the 21st of June. I'll be heading over there to see a little bit of that.
I mean, last year's was a huge success, huge crowds. And again, it's a great field. Marina Voss, the defending champion, is not riding. She's had a difficult year, but Lizzie Armitstead has got to be our favourite. We've also got Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, the world champion, multiple world champion in different disciplines, the French woman who leads the Rabo Live team. I think she's got to be a favourite. I spoke recently with Danny King, who'll be riding for Wiggle Honda. She's been coming back this year from a very nasty crash over the winter. She rode the Tour Britain last year, sorry, the Women's Tour, and she's riding again this year, she hopes. She hadn't had her selection confirmed when we spoke, but here she is just chatting a little bit about last year's Women's Tour and what she hopes for from this year's. Tour Flanders I was at, and Wiggle Honda had a great race there, first and second. The team has changed quite a lot this year. You've lost a few of your British teammates. There's a more international sort of mix to it. Does it feel different, or does it still feel pretty much the same team?
No, it feels quite similar, to be honest. But yeah, it's been incredible this year, you know, especially the Tour of Flanders. I remember watching and, well, following it on social media. Unfortunately, there wasn't any coverage, which is a real shame, which obviously is something that I feel strongly about changing. But yeah, it's been inspiring to watch, and I think that's really helped me, you know, really get back into racing and really want to succeed for the team, because they've had such a good start to the season, and you know, all the new girls have slotted in really nicely and everyone gets on really well, which is nice. So I feel really proud to be a part of such an incredible team, and it's nice to have supported the team. It's my third year, so.
And we're here at the sort of official unveiling of the new sponsor for the Women's Tour, which you rode last year, the inaugural one. Tell us a little bit about what that was like. You know, you mentioned the lack of TV coverage at Tour Flanders, but this felt like an event, didn't it, that was already a major event with major sort of public interest, media interest. What was it like to ride that?
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. You know, like you say, for it to be the first time it was run, to have such support in terms of people lining the roads, 300,000 people lining the roads, 2.2 million people watching on television, even to get that coverage was incredible. So yeah, for Aviva to take over is going to give even more credibility and kudos, I think, to the event. You know, such a big brand, so it's really important for companies like this to support women's cycling. And I think, yeah, it's a privilege for me to be here today and to support that as well. So I'm really looking forward to racing again this year.
Presumably it's one of your big targets for the year. What are your sort of hopes there? What are the team's ambitions there as well?
Yeah, definitely it's one of my targets for the year on the road, for sure. And hopefully I'll have good form going into the race. And I know Wiggle Honda are definitely targeting it, and it would be great to go for stage wins and also GC. I think it's quite nice. We've got riders that can do both. So I know that, you know, I guess we'll have different cards to play, which will be exciting. And, you know, I guess after stage one, see where we're at and just go from there, basically.
Well, Marianne Voss has had a few problems and I think recently injured. So it could be quite an open race, couldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's some incredible teams out there now. Yeah, Rabo Live, Marina Voss' team, Bowles, Lizzie's team. And I think, yeah, it's open to everyone. I think it's going to be a really, really exciting, aggressive race for sure.
What do you know about the stages? Have you studied the courses at all?
A little bit. I'm going to do some course recce for sure, but I know that they're quite similar to last year, quite rolling stages, which I think is quite exciting, because I think it could be a case of some breakaways and not always just a bunch sprint, which it was last year. I think there was only maybe one stage where there was a lone rider that got away. But I think, yeah, it's going to be really exciting, and looking forward to it. The routes look really, really good.
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So we heard there from Danny King. We'll be wrapping up, I think. We'll talk more about the Women's Tour next week. Hopefully Lionel will bring us some exclusive interviews from the race, we hope. And we'll be talking about the Tour de Suisse, which is ongoing at the moment, and looking ahead once more to the Tour de France. We've got an event at Foyle's Bookshop in London this week, which is sold out, which is nice. And that's the perfect Tour de France. We might be putting that out as a podcast as well. We're not made a final decision on that yet, but we may well do. So we've got a busy few weeks coming up. As I say, look out for these forthcoming Friends specials, a couple before or just as the tour gets underway, and then we expect to put more exclusive content behind our paywall during the tour, assuming it all works okay, which I'm sure it will. We've had the very best people working on it. Thank you, Jonathan Rowe, actually, for all your help, and also for producing this week's podcast. Actually, a belated thanks to Jonathan as well for his fine work during the Hour Record, tweeting on our behalf. Did a great job manning the ship. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, all the other people who help us with this podcast. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, chaps.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.